Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellero. And this week, my guest is Indiana University Astronomy Professor, Dr. Catherine Pilichowski. Catherine, welcome.
Nice to be here, John. Good to hear from you.
We've known each other for several years. I think we met in an AAS meeting. And you are a professor at Indiana, my alma mater. Yay.
Yay.
I'm going to introduce you to the listeners here. You are a professor of astronomy at IU Bloomington. You received your BS in physics from Harvey Mudd College in California and an MS and PhD from the University of Hawaii. Your principal research interests include the evolution of stars, the chemical history of the Milky Way galaxy, and the study of the chemical composition and evolution of stars and star clusters. Pretty cool.
I have a good time, for sure.
I was reading in your bio about how you got interested in astronomy. It's a nice story. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. So I'm really a child of the 60s. And way back then, there was a huge push to get kids interested in science, partly because of the space race. My mother had enrolled me in a book club all about science. So every month, I got a book in the mail about some topic or another. And because they came addressed to me, I felt I needed to read every one cover to cover. And I think that's really what got me started. So I love dinosaurs and clouds, meteorology, geology. Astronomy was the real standout. I just loved it. But the other thing that happened because of the 60s was it was a time in astronomy when there were a lot of popular books on the market discussing the topic, the new topic then of stellar evolution. And that's what really got me going, the idea that we could understand these point sources of light, understand their ages of billions of years and how they changed over that long period of time, how they were born, how they died. That whole story just captivated me, but way back then. And it's continued to do so. I'm really lucky that I get to spend my life understanding that better and trying to learn more about it.
You've written that you read books by Asimov. We think of him as a science fiction writer, but he was a biochemistry professor, and he wrote a lot of cool physics science books. I read them too.
He did. They were just wonderful books. They still are wonderful books. They're out of date, but he could tell a science story like no one else.
Really, and George Gamow, 1, 2, 3, Infinity, right?
That one especially, yeah.
That one especially stands out. We all read it.
We did. I guess they were sort of the Neil deGrasse Tysons of their day.
They were. They were.
Wonderful scientists and great communicators.
Were you inspired by Carl Sagan as well?
I didn't meet him until I was in graduate school. He was a collaborator of one of the faculty members at the University of Hawaii and came out to meet, give a talk and stuff like that. I got a chance to meet him. And yes, he was really inspiring. He's an amazing person. He was also a fantastic storyteller. And I think that's what I enjoyed the most was the stories he would tell. The TV personality was great, but in person, he was just wonderful.
You didn't mention science fiction in your bio. Most of us physicists and astronomers were immersed in Heinlein and Clark, and Asimov is a science fiction writer, but you didn't mention that. I'm curious.
Oh, there's no difference. I am as well. Those stories are fantastic. I used to have a rule that I would only read books with rocket ships on the cover. Because the idea of space travel and the complexities of the social interactions and the science, the mixture of those things, I find fascinating.
Yeah, the science fiction inspires the science, which in turn drives the science fiction again. It's that great loop.
Yes, it is wonderful. Yeah. The stories are great.
When you were young, we won't talk about ages here. We're both up there. in those days, were there any strong social impediments regarding women in astronomy? I know there was when I was an undergraduate.
There were. They were breaking down in the 60s substantially, but they were still effects. I remember just as a kid, when I was entering high school, I wanted to take, as a freshman in high school, I was in for my, pre-high school counseling appointment, and I wanted to just go into biology. And the person who was talking to me, my counselor, said, you got to be in science in middle school. Doesn't make sense. You really got to go into general science. You're probably not ready for biology. And I really wanted to go to biology. And I said, well, I don't know why I'm getting these. I really love science. I do really well in science. There's just something about the teacher in middle school that just isn't working, but I belong in biology. And Glory on, she trusted me and put me in biology, and it was just wonderful from that point. I loved every science class I took.
But were there any notable professors who kind of encouraged you and kind of set the stage? Because sometimes one teacher or one professor can say just a couple of words that lights up your life and inspires you.
Yeah, there were a bunch of things, but I think the main influence was a chemistry teacher. Miss Nicholson, absolutely fantastic chemistry teacher.
You said Miss Nicholson?
Miss Nicholson, yes. Ah. So she was unmarried, but had taught chemistry her whole career. And she was a very, very capable chemistry teacher. In fact, she had been collaborating with a group of professional chemists and chemistry educators to write the textbook that we were using. An absolutely fabulous book. But just one of the greatest teachers I've ever known. And she was really an inspiration.
That will do it. That will do it.
That's what makes a difference, the teachers.
How did you make the transition from biology to fascination with stellar composition?
Well, first of all, it was those books. You know, it were many areas of science that I was just fascinated by. What finally forced me to settle into something was having to pick a major in college. And I started my first 2 years, as you mentioned, I was at Harvey Mudd, and there were just a limited choice of majors, so it shouldn't have been hard. But I had to pick one at the end of my sophomore year. And I was interested in chemistry. Math was fascinating. Engineering, the physics, all of that was great. So what I did was I made a list of the courses I wanted to take in my next 2 years and then looked to see what major would work to allow me to take those particular courses. And that turned out to be physics. And for me, that was it. That was the choice, and it was a good one for me.
A lot of astronomers started their careers physics majors for that reason, maybe because they were interested in physics and then expanded into astrophysics, or they, as you said, I wanted to be an astronomer, but the school that they had access to and wanted to go to didn't have an astronomy program. That happened to me.
That's how
I ended up at IU, because IU had a great astronomy program.
Had astronomy, right. So Harvey Mudd didn't. They had a course. There were a couple of courses at Pomona, which that campus has shared courses. So I was able to take a significant amount of astronomy along with the physics. Those were courses on my list. And that did it. I realized that I needed to go to graduate school in astronomy, and I've never turned back. It's just been wonderful.
So you got your bachelor's degree in California, and then you went to Hawaii for your master's and PhD. That's fascinating. Yeah. What took you to Hawaii?
it was another of my teachers. I had a professor who basically said, you know, if you're going to go into astronomy, you want to go to some place that has a telescope, where you can actually go out and use the telescope.
Be an
observer. And at that time, Mauna Kea on the Big Island of Hawaii was just being developed as an astronomical site. It was a really exciting time to be there. They had two little 24-inch telescopes, and their 88-inch was just getting into operation. And it was just fantastic to be at that place at that time. I was the third PhD graduate from their program. And I was only third by about 3 months. So I was going into a brand new program with a brand new observatory, a brand new site, in a fantastic location.
Isn't Mauna Kea about 10,000 feet above sea level?
14,000 feet, yeah.
Oh, I've been to Pikes Peak. Took the COG train up to Pikes Peak here in Colorado at 14,000 feet. You don't want to do anything but lay down.
No, you don't. And also the transition from living and going to school at sea level, and then going from there up to 14,000 feet was that took getting used to. I had one experience that taught me I had to be really careful. I was working with my advisor. We were calibrating some instrumentation, and that particular telescope, the 88-inch, has a doghouse on the back, and there's a ladder that you have to climb to get up to the doghouse. I was working up there and needed a tool. So I said, oh, fine, I'll go downstairs and get it. I climbed down the ladder and went down two flights of stairs to the shop in the basement, picked up the tools we needed, and then said, oh, it's only two flights. I think instead of taking the elevator, I'll just walk up the stairs. So I walked up the stairs and started climbing up the ladder. I got halfway up, and I realized it was about to black out. And I grabbed onto the ladder with both arms and just concentrated incredibly hard on, hold on, don't let go, until I was able to get enough oxygen and not fall. So I learned to be really careful when I'm up at 14,000 feet.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed.
I think I scared him pretty badly, too. But I survived, and so did he.
So after your PhD, you went to NOAO in Tucson.
Actually, I went to Seattle first. I was there four years as a postdoc.
Postdoc, right.
And worked in the astronomy department with Professor George Wallerstein, another amazing guy. He's another role model for me. There are three or four really prominent stellar astrophysicists who have remained active and engaged well beyond their retirement. And that's what I want to do. I just love what I'm doing, just like they always do. And George is still around and still going strong. So, yeah, it was a great time to be in Seattle. But then I did go to Tucson and worked on the staff at the National Optical Astronomy Observatory for more than 20 years. And really enjoyed that, too.
When I worked for Apple, I had the pleasure of being given a tour of Kitt Peak. And I got a photo of me inside the prime focus cage of the Mayo telescope. And that was a fun tour. It was a great night. There was lightning on the horizon, so they didn't have any observing plan, but they were able to do tours. Mm-hmm. And they were able to bring the floor up to the prime focus of the Mayo, and we were able to clamber around it and peer at it. And it was an awesome trip. So you had a part in designing a sister telescope there, the WIN.
Yes, the WIN telescope. So it's almost as big in terms of mirror diameter. It's 3.5 meters compared to the 4 meters of the Mayo. So almost as big, but its building is much smaller. That's because it's located further upwind in better sight. So the building didn't have to be 11 stories tall.
But it's got a more sophisticated mount, too, doesn't it? It allows it to be a little more compact.
It does. It's an Altaz mount, so it doesn't have as big a swing arm and doesn't require as large a volume to contain the telescope as it moves around the sky. So that lets the dome be a lot smaller and cheaper, which is, you know, pretty important these days.
Yeah. Well, nowadays we have some really big telescopes in astronomy, huge ones that are planned. We've had some intermediate ones, the Gemini, the Keck, and the MMT come to mind, but even bigger ones are planned, 10 meters or bigger, maybe even 20 meters planned.
20, 30, 40 meters. There are three projects underway to build telescopes ranging in size from about 20 meters up to about 40 meters.
What do you do with a paltry 3 or 4 meter telescope these days? I mean, those were giants of their day, second only to Mount Palomar, 5 meters. How has the observing program changed with the research, the big time research going to the bigger telescopes? Are these telescopes used by graduate students, or are they still on the front line of research?
It's a mixture of things. Most of the 4 meter class telescopes have switched over to kind of a survey mode. We're doing large surveys of various kinds that you really couldn't afford to do with a very large telescope. But these 4 meter class telescopes are perfect. For example, the 4 meter telescope, the Blanco down in Chile, has a beautiful new camera installed in its prime focus. It takes wide field images and is doing a deep survey of a large region of southern sky. Basically, trying to sort of suss out some of the characteristics of dark energy. The Mayall at Kitt Peak, where you rode around in the prime focus cage, is undergoing right now a major renovation. They're replacing the prime focus cage with a giant fiber bundle thing with little positioners for fibers that will be able to record thousands of different sources at one time over the full field of view of that telescope. Those fibers go down to spectrographs located below the observing floor. And that's being assembled now. It will be commissioned over the next year or so. It's just a remarkable thing. But it will take spectra of millions of galaxies and also tell us a lot about the early evolution of the universe, trying to pin down some of the more esoteric characteristics of dark energy. We'd like to know what it is, and we need to know more about it to figure that out. And these big experiments on the 4 meter class telescopes will help us do that.
Excellent. Well, we're coming to a close in segment one of the show. And so in the second half of the show, I want to talk to you about landing your faculty position at IU and some astrophysics stuff, your research. But we'll get to that in the second half of the show. First, we need to take a short commercial break. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds. I'm chatting with IU astronomy professor, Dr. Katie Pilichowski. We'll be right back.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm chatting with Dr. Katie Pilichowski from Indiana University. So I'm curious about how you landed that faculty position. There's a lot of graduates in astronomy, but few tenured faculty positions, and grabbing one is a real trick. How did you do that?
Well, it's another story associated with the wind telescope on Kitt Peak. So when we started figuring out what to do with this extra mirror that the observatory had, I came up with a suggestion that we needed a multi-object telescope. This has to do with my research. I study globular clusters, and I needed to be able to get stars much faster than one at a time. So we needed a spectrograph that would allow us to get observations of many stars at one time. So I got involved in trying to get my hands on that mirror to build the telescope. At the same time, Indiana and Wisconsin and Yale were beginning to think they needed a telescope as well. We got together, and the wind telescope was a result of this interaction. But as a result, I got to know the faculty here at Indiana pretty well. I was also a longtime friend of Frank Edmondson, whom I'm sure you remember.
Dr. Edmondson was the chair of the Department of Astronomy when I was a student there. He was fantastic. A great mentor, wonderful fellow.
Yeah. Yes. But he was also very active in the Association of Universities for Research in Astronomy, which is the organization that runs Kitt Peak. And I got to know him because of my interactions with the board of that organization and just seeing him frequently and often and having a chance to talk with him. So Frank was able to make a significant contribution to Indiana that eventually led to the formation of this endowed professorship. When it came available for hiring, because I had worked with Wynn and I knew the department, they thought perhaps I might be a good addition to their faculty. So they came out to see me and suggested I apply, and
people,
the rest is history.
Right place, yeah. The right time.
We both got lucky. right people, right place, right time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's cool. So you teach classes as well as do research at IU. What classes do you teach?
So one of the things I love about being here is I do get to teach, and I teach the whole range of courses that we offer. I teach general education courses for non-science majors, which is a whole lot of fun. I also teach an upper division course on stellar astrophysics for our majors and a graduate course on stellar atmospheres for our graduate students. And it's that big range that I enjoy. Right now I'm teaching a course for the non-science majors on cosmology, which is a real challenge. I can't do math and I don't know much physics, but we're really trying to understand the history of our universe and to understand why we think, why we believe what we believe, about how it got started and how it's evolved. It's really been a lot of fun. I'm enjoying that class a lot.
Can you characterize an upswing or a downswing in interest in astronomy in terms of enrollment? Because it's so difficult. I remember when I was an undergraduate, I had a requirement in astrophysics to be proficient in 2 foreign languages. That was a showstopper for some. Is that still in effect? And how are students embracing astrophysics these days?
So it's not in effect anymore. That has changed. It's much easier to be an astronomy major these days. There is still a sort of global studies kind of requirement. Students either have to be proficient in a language or they have to have some sort of overseas experience to help them with the broader cultural sensitivities that we have in the global world of today. So they don't have to learn two languages. That's a big help. And they get the benefit of this opportunity that IU provides for overseas study, which is just a tremendous thing for students to experience. So it's a different world.
Yes. I wanted to ask you, what do you think some of the biggest changes in astronomy technology in the time you've been an astronomer?
Wow, I guess there are three really important things. One is the transition from photographic to digital detectors, which has completely changed how we do science. The second is the use of computers, which has hugely expanded what we can do in science. And the third is the exchange of information through the internet that allows us to collaborate widely around the world, to access data that we could never have access before, to access to information, to literature, in ways that really multiply the ability for us to do research. Those three things are really key.
How do you do your research? Do you work with a team? I know there's the supernova team that discovered the expansion of the galaxy, and that was a collaboration, the expansion of the universe. That was a collaboration amongst a team looking at supernovas. Do you do that, or do you just work with models and graduate students?
Mostly, I'm one of those old-fashioned astronomers. I work with typically a very small group of people, usually a student, occasionally a collaborator from elsewhere. But I'm trying hard to train my students to work in the world that they're in, which is a world of large collaboration and large projects and large data.
Yeah,
so I'm kind of a throwback, but I understand and appreciate the value of the way that things are happening today. I benefit hugely from these large surveys because they provide me all of the background kind of data and information I need to do the work that I do. I get high dispersion spectra. I take huge rainbows of starlight. And I need a lot of information about the stars in order to do that effectively. It's these large surveys that make that possible. So,
do you marry that with computer models that make predictions, or is it all observational?
It's a mixture. So when I have a spectrum, I want to learn something from it. And I actually make a computer model of the spectrum, or rather I make a predictive model. I collect what I believe are the correct parameters that describe a particular star, its temperature, its surface pressure, its overall composition, various things I need to know. And I use that information to make a synthetic spectrum, compare it to the observed spectrum. And then I can use that to figure out how much of an individual element is present in that particular star's atmosphere.
Do you work with atmospheric composition or internal composition or both? Just curious.
I have to work with the atmospheric composition. We can't actually see what's inside. There are ways of modeling very carefully what's inside. And in fact, there are new techniques that allow us to construct very detailed models of what's inside a star. But they don't allow us to get the details of the composition.
Ah.
For that, spectrum of the star, and that only comes from the very outside layer.
Let's do a little bit of PR here for the listeners who may not be quite up to speed. How is it that our star, the sun, has so many metals? How did it come to have that? I mean, when you hear astronomers talk about the atmosphere of the sun, they talk about iron and calcium and all these other metals. How did our sun get that?
Yeah, so that kind of gives an impression that that's what the sun is. But in fact, 90% of the atoms in the sun are hydrogen atoms, and 10% roughly of the atoms in the sun are helium atoms. And you can do the math as well as I can. That doesn't leave a lot for anything else.
No.
the very trace amounts of these particular types of all the other atoms, so iron, calcium, titanium, molybdenum, barium, ruthenium, you name it, they're very, very tiny amounts of each of those heavier elements in the sun. But because of the sun's atmosphere, its outer layer, is at just the right temperature for much of this material to be in excited states. The electrons in the atoms are excited. That allows them to absorb light at particular wavelengths and produce absorption lines in the spectrum of the sun. It's those absorption lines that I'm able to measure. In hotter stars, there are fewer of these lines. In cooler stars, there are many more. In fact, so many it becomes hard to separate them. But in stars like the sun, there's just about right that we can see thousands and thousands of these spectral lines across the whole spectrum of the sun. And it's those fingerprints of individual elements with lines at different particular wavelengths that led us to deduce the composition of the sun and other stars as well.
I'm curious now, were those heavier elements synthesized by the star through nuclear fusion, or were they there when the sun coalesced from the galactic medium?
They were there when the sun coalesced. They were synthesized in previous generations of stars. Uh-huh. And in fact, when we look at meteorites, we can measure, how do I say this? We can determine that there were short-lived radioactive species in the meteorites when the meteorites formed, when the material formed that became the meteorites that we find on Earth. And we could look at the proportion of those water elements from the decay of these radioactive elements and find that a number of them were really fairly short-lived and that they must have been produced shortly before the sun formed. And so we can sort of backtrack a little bit from that and come to the conclusion that there must have been a supernova explosion that perhaps triggered the formation of the sun and that seeded some of these radioactive materials into the early solar system. The majority of material actually was formed probably much earlier than that. But yes, there have been all kinds of things contributing to our solar system.
How does our star compare to other stars? Is it an average star? Is it big, little?
It's pretty average. It's kind of in the middle of the range of stars. Stars range from about a tenth of the mass of the sun up to about 100 times the mass of the sun. Those big guys are really rare. There aren't very many of them. There are lots and lots of the little ones. And the sun is pretty much a normal, ordinary, kind of average star, which is good for us.
Yeah, yeah. We're in the Goldilocks zone. Not too
we
hot,
are.
Not too
yep.
cold.
Yeah. Yep, perfect. And so long-lived.
Another thing you study is globular clusters. That's interesting to me. I wanted to ask you some questions about globular clusters. How do they get formed? How do we think they're formed? And are they stable? Are we seeing a snapshot in time where they're going to dissipate? I mean, you know, they seem to be gravitationally bound, but are they going to be like that forever? How does that work?
Well, forever is a long time.
Yeah.
But yes, those globular clusters have been there a long time. We think they were probably amongst the very first really massive star-forming events in the universe. And they formed these star clusters that have a few hundred thousand to a million stars that have been held together by gravity for 13 billion years. They're very old.
Oh. Do they play a role in the rest of the gravitational building of the galaxy's structure?
They're part of that process, probably.
Yeah.
But they've survived all the tidal influences of the galaxy. The weakest, smallest of them have been shredded apart. But the big ones are still around and will be around for a long, long time to come. They do evolve dynamically. They change over time, but very slowly. And the bigger they are, the more slowly they change.
When you look at the chemical composition of the stars in those clusters, and I think if I understand it correctly, you can tie the chemical composition of those stars to how the cluster was formed. Is that right?
We're trying to, and we're still mystified about some things we've learned about globular clusters. We used to think that all the stars formed at one time all had the same chemical composition. We now know that they don't. There are variations in the pattern of abundances of different elements from one star to another in these clusters. And that indicates that there was a very complex process through their formation. And we still don't understand exactly how it happened. That process produced at least two, and in some cases several, different subgroupings of stars that are contaminated with products of a particular type of nuclear fusion. And we don't know where or how it happened. So it's one of the big mysteries about the globular clusters.
Wow. Do we think dark matter played a role in their coalescing?
We don't know. As far as we can tell today, the globulars don't contain or are not embedded in dark matter. They seem to be unusual in that respect. There are similar kinds of objects called dwarf galaxies that have similar masses to globular clusters, but are embedded in dark matter. And understanding the difference between these dwarf galaxies and the globular clusters is another goal that I think we need to try to figure out. We don't know the answer either to that one.
Cool. It's very interesting research that you're doing. It's fascinating. Well, we're coming to the close of the show, and I only have a couple minutes left to ask you another final question. And I think you're uniquely suited to answer this question because of your career. If a young person came to you in high school and said, I want to be an astronomer, what would you tell them? What would you tell them to study? And how would you tell them to form their career?
Oh, wow. Okay. So number one, math. And probably the second number one is learning to write. People get surprised when I say that. But astronomers spend a lot of time writing. We have to communicate. We have to publish our results. We have to write proposals to get telescope time and get funding to support our research. So that writing turns out to be really important.
I've met math geeks who got 800 on their SAT math, and then they're terrible in English and couldn't write an English sentence to save their lives.
That writing
no
is
good.
Important. Yep, got to do both.
Yeah.
So writing and math. If a student doesn't love math, then it will be very difficult for them to be successful in any physical science.
Is it required these days to take calculus in high school so you're ready, or can calculus wait till your freshman year of college these days?
It can wait until the freshman year. And in fact, we encourage students who have taken calculus in high school to repeat it in college. Often the sort of kind of things they learn in college versus high school calculus are a little different. And so we really encourage students not to try to jump ahead. We want them to take calculus in high school, but not to hesitate to repeat some of that when they get to college. They end up learning it better and doing better in the long run.
And I imagine they should take any physics that they can get in high school to get ready for college astronomy.
Oh, yes. The more physics, the better. Often, of course, many schools nowadays have two physics courses that students can take, both regular physics and AP physics, that kind of build on each other. And the more physics, the better. Physics is great.
Well, this brings us to the close of the show. I want to thank you so much for this grand tour of your career and astronomy and advice to young students and your research interests. It's all been just terrific. Thank you for joining me and sharing.
Happy to join you. It's been fun.
Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
So they can contact me at my email address here at Indiana University. It's cpilacho, C-P-I-L-A-C-H-O, at indiana.edu. Or they can just Google me and come up pretty close to the top of the list if they Google Pilachowski.
All right, cool. Well, Katie, thank you very much again for being on the show. It was a pleasure.
My pleasure, John.
Folks, you've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you again next week.